5 years ago, Rohingyas were forced out of Myanmar. Now many fear being forced back.
Myanmar is sadly not a safe place for the Rohingya today. Myanmar is not a safe place for most people today.
They're in refugee camps with little freedom of movement. I'm Carol Hills. In Germany, the first passenger train fleet powered by hydrogen.
The ride will be quieter because, of course, if you have a diesel motor in your train, that makes noise. It also produces some fumes. Basically, all you get out of a fuel cell is just some steam.
But will the ride actually be greener? And Kenya's rising tennis star can't even remember the first time she picked up a racket.
I just remember myself being happy in a tennis court. Yeah.
Now she's encouraging other Kenyans to play.
The future of tennis in Kenya, it's really bright.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's a somber anniversary today, 5 years since hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims were driven from Myanmar. At the time, soldiers carrying rifles and machetes torched the homes of Rohingya families, burning many villages to the ground. One UN official called it a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Many of the exiles walked to neighboring Bangladesh. Today, nearly 1 million remain there in what's become the world's most densely populated refugee camp. Burmese human rights activist Mon Zarni says they're stuck in a kind of limbo there.
They are not accorded the freedom of movement. Rohingyas cannot move from one refugee camp to the other. And if Rohingya pick up the Bengali local or national language and enroll themselves in the Bangladeshi classrooms, they are taken out by the Bangladeshi government.
Shana Bauchner, a researcher in the Asia division at Human Rights Watch, has focused on the situation the Rohingya find themselves in. Shana, take us back to the start of this saga 5 years ago. How and why were the Rohingya expelled from Myanmar?
Sure. So today is the anniversary. August 25th, 2017 was the start of Myanmar military's sweeping campaign of atrocities, genocidal acts. But that level of violence didn't come out of nowhere. It was the culmination of decades of discrimination, persecution, severe restrictions that Myanmar authorities had placed on the Rohingya population living in the country.
And is there a simple way to describe why the Rohingya, there's many ethnic groups and religious groups in Myanmar, why the Rohingya in terms of expelling them?
Yeah, so Myanmar authorities have for decades identified the Rohingya because of their ethnicity and their religion as Muslims as an existential threat to the Buddhist state of Myanmar. They are denied citizenship under the country's citizenship law, so they're effectively stateless, and that has allowed their ongoing persecution to continue.
So what is the situation for these refugees today?
There's nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees in the camps in Bangladesh. Many have been there for 5 years. Hundreds, thousands were there from previous waves of violence. The situation is dire. They are increasingly hopeless. They're facing severe funding shortages. They are facing increasing restrictions on their ability to study, to work, to move freely under the Bangladesh authorities, who are becoming increasingly frustrated with having to host this massive refugee population. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what they're asking for is the chance to go home. Unfortunately, the conditions in Myanmar and the abuses that are being carried out by the Myanmar junta make that possibility fairly remote today.
Have many Rohingya refugees returned to Myanmar over the past 5 years?
Not many. Some have informally. There have not been formal returns. In February 2021, the same military generals who orchestrated the genocidal acts against the Rohingya in 2017 launched a coup and evicted the civilian government in Naypyidaw in Myanmar. And so the conditions since then have only gotten worse.
Getting back to the Rohingya refugees, I want to ask about the conditions on an island that many were relocated to by Bangladesh. What is going on there? Where is that island and what are the conditions there?
Baksan Char is an island that is fairly isolated. It is flood prone. Bangladesh identified it as a location that it decided it wanted to send a number of Rohingya refugees, and it set up a camp on the island. It has so far sent about 28,000 Rohingya refugees to Basanchar. Many who we've spoken with have been sent there without their full informed consent. Many who are on the island talk about severe movement restrictions, that they're not able to work there, that they don't have access to medical care or sufficient food. Many want to return to the main camps in Cox's Bazar and are being prevented from doing so by Bangladesh authorities.
And Cox's Bazar is the community in Bangladesh, very near the Myanmar border, where the majority of these million refugees are.
Yes, exactly.
Now, Bangladesh wants the Rohingya refugees out, but many Rohingya themselves are worried about being forcibly repatriated to Myanmar. Is Myanmar a safe place for them today?
Myanmar is not a safe place for most people in the country today. Under the military junta's rule, most people in the country are facing extreme brutality of the sort that was committed against the Rohingya in 2017.
Just today, we learned that Myanmar's military junta has arrested a former British ambassador and her husband, who's a Burmese artist. Who are they, and what's the significance of their arrest?
So Vicky Bowman was the former British ambassador. This follows recent further convictions of Aung San Suu Kyi. It follows earlier the execution of four democracy activists. The Myanmar military is not an institution that can be negotiated with. This is not a situation where they should be brought to a negotiating table. They need to start to face serious consequences for the crimes they're carrying out, including these fully ridiculous charges that they're bringing against anyone who they've identified as a threat to their abusive rule.
But why a British ambassador? I mean, is it because her husband's a Burmese artist who's spoken out against the Burmese military, or is it a message to Britain? Why these people?
It's not yet clear. You know, there have been different foreigners who have been arrested since the junta took power for different reasons that they identify either as some sort of threat or having some ties to the opposition movement.
So what are the options here? I mean, what sort of international effort is needed to address this refugee crisis of Rohingyas and get them home safely? I mean, what's the end game?
In terms of the situation for the refugees, donors can certainly increase their commitment to the response, increase their funding, so that the current response is only funded at about a quarter of what they need. They can increase pressure on Bangladesh to grant the refugees access to school and work so that even as refugees, they can have the opportunity to build toward more self-reliant and independent futures. In terms of the possibility to return home, that's going to depend on the international community achieving justice for the Rohingya. That can happen at the International Court of Justice, where there's currently an ongoing case against Myanmar brought by Gambia. And it can happen if the UN Security Council puts forward a resolution putting the situation to the International Criminal Court, which will help bring individual accountability for the crimes committed against the Rohingya.
Shayna Bachner is a researcher in the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. Today marks the fifth anniversary of the expulsion of Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. Thanks a lot, Shayna.
Thank you.
Climate change is really expensive. The global damage from extreme weather and other impacts could top $20 trillion by mid-century. That's according to one of the world's largest reinsurers, Swiss Re. People on low-lying islands already suffer as rising sea levels wash away their homes. Some are looking to big polluters to cover part of the costs of climate change, and they're taking them to court. The world's Patrick Nguyen reports.
On the Indonesian island of Pari, fear comes in with the tide. Every year, seawater swallows more of the island, which is already tiny, smaller than Central Park. The waters can swell at night, so people go to bed worrying they'll wake up to ankle-deep water in their bedrooms. That's a child on Pari Island playing in his yard, which has turned into a murky lake. By some estimates, the whole island will be underwater in a few decades.
The island will be submerged, or big parts of the island. The question is just how fast.
Nina Burris is an attorney with Hex Epper, a Swiss aid group. She is helping four people from Pari Island sue the world's largest cement company, Holcim, which is based in Switzerland. What did this corporation do to hurt these islanders? Nothing directly. But Burris says it did emit nearly one half of 1% of all the industrial carbon dioxide ever released into the air. She says these emissions made glaciers melt faster. It made seas rise higher. And so the company should help pay for damage to flooded homes on Pari Island. Not for all the damages, just roughly one half of 1%.
They only caused a part of it. That's clear. And the islanders don't want to ask for more.
But why go after Holcim? Why not sue ExxonMobil? Why not sue the U.S. military, which consumes more oil than any other institution? Nina Burris says we could have.
Theoretically, they could go after all the contributors to climate change, but Holcim specifically contributed to a very, very large extent because they produce cement.
The cement industry is right behind oil when it comes to emissions. Scientists can now prove how much carbon a company emitted going back centuries. And that is paving the way for this kind of lawsuit.
I think it's a creative but absolutely reasonable argument. It's more than reasonable.
In Peru, there's a farmer who says a glacier near his house will soon melt and flood his property. He's suing an energy firm in Germany, RWE, just because it burns a lot of coal. That case is in the German courts. There are roughly 2,000 climate lawsuits globally. Most target governments, but more and more seek damages from corporations.
I think we will see more and more of these cases because communities simply cannot afford to pay the skyrocketing costs of climate change.
That's Fiona Koza, a climate accountability strategist with the group West Coast Environmental Law. She's helping cities in Canada build a lawsuit against big oil. Vancouver has signed up. The city's budget for things like fighting wildfires or maintaining seawalls is already in the tens of millions. COSA will also use cutting-edge emissions analysis to seek damages. If, say, Shell Energy churns out roughly 0.5% of all industrial carbon each year, which it does, a city might demand that Shell pay for that percentage of its climate-related cost.
Certainly, some people are skeptical about whether suing companies is realistic, but you just have to remember the successful lawsuits against big tobacco, big pharma, and the asbestos industry.
That's Edie Mogliano, a Pari Islander, chatting with neighbors as he mends a fishing net. Seawater has badly damaged his house. Edie and other plaintiffs will face Holcim this fall, through their lawyers, at a mediation with judges in Switzerland. If that fails, the case goes to court. Nina Burris, the attorney, says this lawsuit is not really about money. Combined, the four plaintiffs are only asking for $15,000. Just 0.5% of their cost.
But then the main claim they want is that Holcim reduces emissions.
The islanders want the company to bring its emissions down by more than 40% to help prevent the submersion of other islands. Holcim, the cement company, says, "We do take climate action very seriously." It says it plans to get down to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Company representatives also say sorting out who owes what and climate damages should happen at the United Nations, not through lawsuits targeting businesses. Nina Burris says cases like this may fail at first, but eventually, she says, one will succeed and put every polluting corporation on high alert.
It cannot be that you can calculate very clearly who caused damage, but they are not paying for it. The climate crisis cannot be a law-free zone.
For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
Later this hour, how climate policy and foreign policy go hand in hand. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. French President Emmanuel Macron arrived in Algeria today. He's on a mission to improve his country's relationship with its former colony. The visit follows controversial statements Macron made about the North African country last year. For a look at relations between the two countries, we're turning to Intisar Fakir. She's a North Africa expert and senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Intisar, what were the damaging statements Macron made about Algeria last year?
During a conversation that he was having with descendants and children of French Algerian citizens, Macron was making some big, broad, sweeping comments about Algeria's history, during which he was trying to make the point that instead of the current regime blaming everything that is wrong with the country on French colonialism, that they should try to sort of think a little bit beyond that and try to kind of take a more positive outlook. And over the course of those comments, he had sort of asked this kind of rhetorical question, was there an Algerian state before the French arrived in Algeria? And that comment really generated a lot of anger and condemnation among Algerian officials and also among the Algerian public.
Is there any grain of truth to what Macron said?
So if he's referring to the current, you know, modern state with all of the trappings that we know today, then that's it. Then you know, maybe there is some accuracy to what he's describing. But, you know, I think it's important to look at the history of Algeria within the context and the time period in which it played out. I don't think it's a very valid point to look at Algeria and say, you know, was there an Algerian state before that, and sort of have that be kind of an answer to some of the more problematic elements of the bilateral relationship that he was referring to.
So there's obviously this long colonial legacy, but today, what are the main challenges in the French-Algerian relationship? I mean, what are the most pressing issues?
There is a big Algerian diaspora in France. There are a lot of issues of racism and of discrimination that continue to carry out. There is a very practical element of that, though, which is the question of visa. And this was very much part of what drew the anger and condemnation of Algerian officials last year, and what led to the rupture that we saw last summer.
What's the visa issue?
The French government had decided to cut the number of visas that they issue to North African countries because they thought that if they did that, they could essentially force these North African countries to try to handle illegal migration on their side. Part of that is taking back some of the illegal migrants that have been, you know, kind of found in France. And these governments really struggled as a result of slashing the number of visas that they give to people. We're talking about people that were suddenly not able to visit their families. We're talking about businessmen that were not able to access their businesses and to continue their affairs. So that's been a very contentious issue between France, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco as well.
What about the ties that bind them? I mean, what do these two countries need from each other?
As you know, Algeria is a big exporter of gas to Europe, not just France, to all of Europe. There's also Algeria's relationship with Russia, which adds sort of another layer of complexity to this visit that Macron is undertaking at this moment. Algeria has always had very strong ties to Russia. Russia supplies Algeria with arms. And I think part of what Macron is trying to do during this visit is to essentially say to the Algerian authorities, you know, we are here. We may not have always gotten along in the past, but there is a lot more that connects us. And, you know, essentially just remember that we are your friends despite recent tension.
I'm curious what kind of strategic role Algeria plays in Northern Africa and whether France has security goals on its mind in this week's visit.
Of course, Algeria plays a big role also in regional security, not just in North Africa, but also in the Sahel. And that's something that's very important for France right now, given the recent diplomatic break between France and Mali. And so I think part of the aim here is to say to Algeria, okay, is there a way that we can work together on the Sahel, you know, now that, you know, France is no longer in Mali? And I think that the point is to see in what way they can, you know, make use or try to kind of identify common goals with Algeria and Algerian military and the Algerian government to see if there's a way that they can work together on Mali, which is also a big problem. You know, instability there is also a problem for Algeria as well.
Intisar Fakir is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Intisar, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
What did you do on your summer vacation? Kids all over will be getting that question as they return to classes. One British-Belgian teenage pilot has an answer that will be really hard to top. The world's Bianca Hillier has a story.
Mac Rutherford is no stranger to the skies. At just 17 years old, he has already been flying solo for a few years. But yesterday, he finished his biggest adventure to date.
This is the last flight of my journey, so incredible the thing that I've been able to get so far. It's all coming to an end.
Rutherford posted updates to social media along the way. And as he landed in the capital of Bulgaria...
Touchdown.
he became the youngest person to ever fly solo around the world. The trip took him to 30 countries and 4 continents.
So right now, I'm flying right over the Egyptian desert. This is one of the most amazing sights ever.
He spent 221 hours in the air, and his longest flight was 10 hours, from Japan to the States. There were some administrative speed bumps along the way.
So I'm still currently stuck in Dubai, waiting for my Iran visa and permit.
He also had to reroute a few times due to weather conditions and Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
So I'm no longer going through Russia. So instead of going north through Kazakhstan, then Russia, I'm going east through Pakistan, India, China, South Korea, Japan, and then straight over to the U.S.
If you want to get technical, Rutherford wasn't just alone with his thoughts the entire time. Locals greeted him at airports along the way, and some even joined him in the skies.
I've just had one of the most exciting but terrifying experiences at the same time on this journey. I had an eagle fly past me, and I'm not kidding, it was about 2 meters away from actually hitting the plane.
In total, Rutherford's trip took 5 months. Once safely on the ground, he posted a final update.
I'm definitely going to miss flying, but also with this journey, I'm trying to show that young people can make a difference. You don't have to be 18 to do something special. Just work hard, and you can follow your dreams.
As for his own inspiration, Mac Rutherford didn't have to look far. His older sister, Zara Rutherford, actually made the global journey first. In January, at 19 years old, she became the youngest woman to fly around the world alone. Little bro said he couldn't have done it without her guidance.
I always knew I wanted to do something special in my aviation career, but it's only after Zara flew around the world that I knew, yes, this is what I want to do. So she actually helped me bring me to this point.
Nothing like a little healthy sibling rivalry thousands of feet in the air. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. An all-out offensive in the Tigray region of Ethiopia interrupts attempts at peace talks there.
This is the first sort of serious sustained clash, particularly between the federal and the Tigray forces this year.
Both sides accuse the other of launching the attack while a grave humanitarian crisis grinds on. And why the U.S. needs to look abroad to meet its climate targets. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH and PRX. This week, the German state of Lower Saxony introduced what may be the first fleet of hydrogen power passenger trains in the world. To reduce greenhouse gas emissions, 14 trains powered by hydrogen fuel cells are replacing diesel-powered trains. John Wirth, a European train expert and activist, joins us from Aachen, Germany. John, let's start with the basics. How does a train powered by a hydrogen fuel cell work?
Basically, a way and means of powering a train by electricity, but without doing it the old way, by having an electrified wire above the track. What you do is you fill the train up with hydrogen. That then, through the fuel cell, produces electricity and drives an electric motor that moves your train forward. So that's the basic principle of how it will work.
From a passenger point of view, is the ride any different? I mean, is it better, faster, cleaner anyway?
So the ride will be quieter because, of course, if you have a diesel motor in your train, that makes noise, also produces some fumes. Basically, all you get out of a fuel cell is just some steam being produced. And also then the electric motors are much quieter than a diesel engine. So those are the main changes that as a passenger you will notice. Of course, actually, the production on the spot there, right, there is no pollution produced by the train itself. Now, that's where it then gets a bit more complicated with hydrogen power trains. How is the hydrogen itself produced? And that obviously doesn't happen exactly where the train is actually running, but elsewhere. And indeed, a train that's powered by hydrogen will run no faster, so you won't get to your destination any more quickly than you would with an old diesel one.
You mentioned the need to create the hydrogen fuel in the first place. And right now, the cheapest and most popular way to do it is using fossil fuels. So the company that makes the fuel for these trains says it's going to make that fuel using renewable energy within 3 years. But I understand that this need for additional renewable energy to create hydrogen fuel raises its own issues. What are they?
That's the very much the crux of it. Producing hydrogen is itself an energy intensive process. And that means the overall energy efficiency of a hydrogen powered train is not as good as one which is powered the old way with an overhead live electric cable. And so that's the principal criticism against hydrogen trains. They're not very energy efficient. And the second point is, you touched upon it there in your question, is do we have enough hydrogen which is produced using renewable electricity to mean this is a really genuinely green option? And so those are the kind of criticisms which are raised by those that say such a train, the hydrogen power train, is basically kind of greenwashing, essentially. The train itself looks good, but when you start checking the energy intensity of the production of the hydrogen in the first place, then it doesn't really look as green.
Okay, another question. Germany's train lines are already primarily electric, and across Europe, lines are converting to run on electricity. What's the advantage of hydrogen-powered trains over the basic electric trains?
I would say there is no advantage of hydrogen trains over regular electric trains. And indeed, actually, I would say that a regular electric train is actually a better bet. The problem and the reason why we are talking about hydrogen trains, and indeed in Germany as well, about battery electric trains, is precisely that electrifying the line in the traditional way, so putting up a powered cable above the track, is very expensive. It is a big one-off capital investment. And that's then the criticism of that route, which is to say, hey, hang on a minute, that's too expensive to put up the cables the old way. We need a faster solution, a cheaper solution in the first instance, and hydrogen might be that. But the energy efficiency of it is not as good as the other options. And it's particularly problematic if your hydrogen is not produced in a sustainable and green way.
So at this point, how prevalent are electric trains in Germany, the traditional electric trains?
So traditional electric trains are about 70% of tracks in Germany are electrified. It therefore means that 30% that are not electrified are rather small lines, often serving smaller towns and villages. And so therefore, all of the main trains in Germany between the major cities are all electrified the traditional way. Now, there's a very interesting point, potentially, however, for your listeners, is it's the opposite in Europe than it is in the United States. Apart from the Northeast Corridor, there from Boston through New York City to Washington, D.C., which has electrified railways, most railway lines in the United States are not electrified. So as I see it, there's this kind of somewhat strange situation that a hydrogen train, for me, actually has much more potential in the United States than it would have in Germany or in France. And so it's kind of ironic somehow that actually these first trains in operation are actually in Germany rather than somewhere nearer to you there in Boston.
John Wirth runs the campaign Trains for Europe, which advocates for more night trains across Europe. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
When Serena Williams announced this month that she will soon be leaving competitive tennis, it was big news. The 23-time Grand Slam winner has inspired generations of tennis players around the world, including in Kenya, where one rising star calls Williams her idol. The World's Halima Gikandi brings us her story from Nairobi.
Last month, Kenyan tennis player Angela Okutoy stepped onto the court of the Wimbledon Tennis Championship in London. The 18-year-old was determined to win her junior doubles match. She and her partner fiercely hit balls back and forth, and then they won.
Kenya, for the first time ever, has a Wimbledon champion.
Okutoy won Kenya's first Wimbledon trophy. A month later, that high still hasn't worn off. I meet Okutoy at her sports club in Nairobi.
I was crying and it was really emotional. And it has always been my dream to be in a Grand Slam and to win a Grand Slam title for my country. So it was really a good thing for me.
Okutoy has been playing tennis for most of her life. She first picked up the racket at just 4 years old. I asked her if she remembers those early days.
Well, I don't remember, but I just remember myself being happy in a tennis court. Yeah.
Happy, but not easy. It's been a long road for her to get here. Okutoy tells me her mother died in childbirth, so she and her sister were raised by their grandmother, who often struggled to make ends meet.
It wasn't easy while growing up. I remember there were times where we didn't have the meal, and I would I would still go and practice and play. And maybe the only meal I would see was dinner. And maybe dinner, it was just water, but I would still survive.
Okutoye says that experience molded her into who she is today, a fierce and determined tennis player with a strong forehand and aggressive baseliner style that is reminiscent of that of her idol, Serena Williams.
I know her background is kind of like mine. She didn't grow up in a well-up family, but she still managed to achieve what she has achieved. So she's a really inspirational for me.
Okutoye tells me when she first started playing tennis, she didn't really recognize her own talent. But for the people around her, it was obvious. At 6 years old, Okutoye was winning tournaments against older kids.
Since those days, they were telling me, like, I'm really good in tennis and I can be the best. And I believe from what I've been doing, winning the trophies when I was young, I think that's when I got the belief and the confidence that, yeah, maybe, yeah, I can actually be good in this sport of tennis.
Of course, these days, Okutoye is doing much more than just good. Since she won Wimbledon, she's been getting a lot of attention at home. The media, companies, government officials, and schools all want to talk with her. Veronica Osogo, a tennis coach, says Okutoye is inspiring a new generation of Kenyans. Parents are flooding in, asking her how they can get their kids involved in the sport.
So many parents, if you come here on Saturday or the neighboring club, it's full. It's parents bringing their children, like, because every time you turn around, it's Angela has done it.
Osogo also says that the sport has changed a lot since she started out. For years, she has been running tennis programs in Nairobi's slums. She says historically, tennis in Kenya was a sport for the wealthy.
In the past years, the children who've been playing tennis in Kenya are mostly from the underprivileged communities. So it's just changed the notion that it has to be for the rich.
Osogo tells me that Okutoye has also shown Kenyans that you can succeed in tennis even when you have limited resources or facilities. I ask Okutoye where she sees tennis going in Kenya.
The future of Kenya in tennis, it's really bright, and hopefully to see lots of Kenyan players on the top and to even do more greater things than what I've done.
Okutoye tells me she is just getting started. For the World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
After months of dialogue, fighting broke out once again yesterday near the embattled Tigray region of Ethiopia. It's the first large-scale offensive there in a year. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was deeply shocked and saddened by the news.
My strong appeal is for an immediate cessation of hostilities and for the resumption of peace talks.
Joining us now is William Davison, the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Ethiopia. He joins us from Cambridge, England. William, both sides in the conflict say the other attacked first. What do we know about what actually happened yesterday?
Well, I'm afraid it's rather hard to verify those claims at the moment. All we know is that this is the first sort of serious sustained clash, particularly between the federal and the Tigray forces this year. So it marks a major breach of a humanitarian truce that's been in place since March between the two parties.
Well, what does each side say the other did?
Well, they are both accusing each other of being the aggressor and so only responding with defensive action. And this is in the context of efforts to get a peace process underway, sort of direct talks amidst this truce. But that process has really failed to get off the ground with differences over the mediator and other issues. So we've seen an increase in sort of belligerent statements over the last few weeks, positions hardening, and then reports of federal mobilization along with some regional allies in advance of this outbreak of conflict yesterday.
Now, I want you to remind us of what this conflict is all about. Is there just a really simple way to describe what's going on here? Because it's a really difficult conflict.
There's not really a simple way, unfortunately, but Ethiopia has a federal system with plenty of regional autonomy on paper. And one of its regions in 2020 fell into a serious electoral and constitutional dispute with the federal government. Both accused each other of being illegitimate, and that led to the outbreak of war, with the federal government essentially trying to replace the regional ruling party. And since then, there has been a sort of back and forth conflict, primarily between the federal and Tigray regional government forces, but also involving Eritrea's army, Eritrea, the country to the north, as well as other regional governments lined up alongside the federal government.
But at this point, Tigray, that region, has been completely isolated and lacks kind of basic ways of communicating. Can you describe the humanitarian situation there?
Yet the main problem for the region has been that the federal government and its allies have essentially cut it off from having a normal trading relationship with the rest of Ethiopia. Humanitarian aid deliveries have also been massively interrupted, and critical federally provided services, so banking, telecoms, and electricity, they've also been cut off by the federal government. So these restrictions, combined with the impact of the conflict, which included the federal government, Eritrean troops, looting and damaging sort of education, health, and agricultural equipment and infrastructure inside Tigray. This obviously created a massive economic and humanitarian crisis in the region. So there has been some increase in the delivery of food aid as part of this truce this year. But because of all those cumulative problems, there is a large proportion of a regional population in Tigray of around 6 million who are desperately in need of assistance. And it's obviously it's had a very serious impact in terms of increased mortality already.
There have been some talks to try to come to a peace agreement. Where did those stand before this renewed fighting started?
Both the federal and the Tigray government made commitments to peace talks. The federal government named a negotiating committee, but there haven't actually been any formal face-to-face negotiations. There was an argument about the mediator. The federal government favors the African Union envoy. Tigray's leadership would like to see the Kenyan leadership lead the mediation. And then there was also issues related to the blockade. So Tigray's government says that those services, telecoms, banking, etc., they must be restored prior to talks. And the federal government says that that will occur as part of sort of negotiating a ceasefire. So these types of differences have prevented the parties even sitting around the table. And once they do sit around the table, there's going to be some incredibly difficult issues to resolve through negotiation.
Do you feel like the conflict in the Tigray region in Ethiopia is being overshadowed by global concern about Ukraine?
I think undoubtedly there was a significant deflection in media and government, et cetera, attention when the Ukraine crisis broke out. But it does tend to be the case that these types of conflicts only get significant attention when they're at their most sort of critical and ultimately violent stages. So yes, that's definitely been a dynamic, but at the same time, there has been at times plenty of diplomatic and humanitarian and media attention on this conflict. And so far, it hasn't done anything to resolve the differences between the Ethiopian protagonists, but also a major part of this conflict is the long-running disagreement between Tigray's leadership and the Eritrean leadership as well. So it is a complex issue to resolve.
What do you want people in the U.S. to understand about this conflict? I mean, it can seem pretty far away from Americans' daily concerns.
I think people should understand that the gravity of it, just how desperate the situation is, yes, for people inside Tigray, also people elsewhere in Ethiopia, as a result of the overall predicament that the country faces, political, economic, security-wise, 30 million Ethiopians are in need of assistance. We don't even know, how many people have perished directly in the civil war. It's not the only incident of conflict that's occurring in Ethiopia right now. So I think people should really understand the gravity of this situation, how it's affecting tens of millions of Ethiopians. Hopefully that will create a bit more momentum for the international actors to try, and the federal government and the other parties to take the necessary measures here to bring about peace or at least significantly reduce the violence.
William Davison is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Ethiopia. He joined us from Cambridge in the UK. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Our morning newsletter gives you three top stories, some of our journalists' dispatches from around the globe, and a good news story to brighten your day, sent directly into your inbox. Subscribe to our newsletter, Top of the World, at theworld.org. The Inflation Reduction Act promises nearly $400 billion to address the U.S. carbon footprint. It's the largest climate investment in the country's history. The legislation is focused domestically with things like clean energy subsidies and expedited permits for solar and wind farms. But our next guest says for the legislation to reach its full potential, U.S. leaders also need to look abroad. Jason Bordoff is co-founding dean of the Columbia Climate School and a former Obama climate change advisor. advisor. Jason, what foreign policy measures do you think the U.S. needs to enact to maximize the climate impact of this new legislation?
I think there are some foreign policy tools that we need to make sure the Inflation Reduction Act is effective at home. So the Inflation Reduction Act puts a huge amount of government subsidies to work supporting clean energy. It also has industrial policy components in it. By that, I mean requirements for many of these things to be produced and made in the United States to spur domestic economic activity and jobs. You want to be careful that that doesn't spark a trade war with retaliation from other countries, but leads to a virtuous cycle of competition, not a vicious cycle of protectionism, so that those countries put in place measures that complement what we're doing. And then secondly, we should remember that the United States is only around 11-12% of global emissions. So as much as we do, we're only going to deal with the climate crisis if lots of other countries are doing work to reduce emissions as well. If the United States Inflation Reduction Act can help put a lot of subsidies to work to lower the cost of clean energy, we make that energy more affordable for other parts of the world, particularly low-income countries that haven't developed economically yet, did not cause the climate crisis. But then we need to use tools of development finance and export support to help make sure that those technologies reach places in emerging markets or sub-Saharan Africa and gives them access to develop in a cleaner way than we did after the Industrial Revolution.
So you mentioned the potential of a trade war. How can foreign policy help avoid that?
I think through diplomacy, first and foremost, and then I think there are ways to cooperate with other countries that are also thinking about how to use trade policy to, again, encourage more countries to take stronger climate action and not lead to protectionism or tariffs or restrictive policies. The European Union, for example, has talked about having a so-called border adjustment where countries that have taken strong climate action work together to have favorable trading relationships between them. And countries that have not might see their more carbon-intensive goods like steel or cement have a tariff imposed to be imported. And you can create sort of cooperative clubs of countries that helps to elevate standards and encourage people to take stronger climate action moving forward.
Massive increases in renewable energy infrastructure will require commodities from overseas. You've mentioned that, like cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo, lithium from Chile, nickel from the Philippines. These countries aren't all kind of buddy-buddy countries. How do you think the world can avoid conflict over these minerals?
Critical minerals is a hugely important issue for the clean energy transition. As you said, batteries, solar panels, lots of clean energy inputs require these minerals that are mined in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo or China, others as well. The largest lithium producer is Australia, for example. And we have a lot of capacity to do some of that mining in the United States. The bill is designed to require that if you want the electric vehicle tax credit, for example, the batteries in the electric cars come from components that were mined either in the United States or in free trade partners of the United States. That's hard to do. It takes 16 years on average to develop a new mine for one of these things. And mining, if you don't do it carefully, can be pretty destructive environmentally. So we need to put in place permitting reforms and a set of environmental rules that allow us to move quickly to develop mining activity, both in the U.S. and abroad. But we should anticipate that even a decade from now, we'll still be heavily dependent on imports for some of these critical minerals. And then we want to think about where security of supply comes from. Just like in the global oil market, you don't want all your oil, or if you're in Europe right now, you don't want all your gas to come from Russia. We probably don't want all of our critical minerals to come from China. We want to think about policies that will help diversify supply, maybe build up strategic stockpiles for some of these things, again, as we did with oil after the 1970s oil crisis.
And we're speaking with Jason Bordoff of the Columbia Climate School. He was also a former climate change advisor to Barack Obama. Jason, do you see the Inflation Reduction Act as likely to galvanize similar types of legislation in other high-emitting countries?
I do. I think it, look, the Inflation Reduction Act is the largest investment made in clean energy in U.S. history. It is really a historic achievement. It enhances U.S. credibility to be able to have negotiations with other countries around the world. We should remember it's being passed in a moment of severe energy crisis as well. So there's a climate crisis, there is also an energy crisis, and I fear it will last for several years. And so if you look at the countries where emissions are growing the fastest, South Asia, India, lower income countries like Bangladesh or Pakistan. These are countries that are struggling to afford any energy supplies at all now, coal, oil, gas, all of which are going up, not down, by the way. I have worried for a while that if energy security and affordability come into tension with climate ambition will lose out. So we need to make sure that we're dealing with today's energy crisis, but remember that we would not be in as severe an energy crisis today if we were less dependent on globally traded hydrocarbons, which are inevitably exposed to geopolitical risk like Russia. There is an argument from a national security standpoint, as well as a climate standpoint, to move faster to shift toward electrification of the economy and some lower carbon sources of energy, because the less dependent you are on oil and gas, you also have energy security benefits. You're less vulnerable to some of these geopolitical risks.
If you had President Biden's ear, what would you say to him?
Well, I would say thank you first for how extraordinary an achievement the Inflation Reduction Act was, and it wasn't easy to get done in a divided Congress, and just a reminder that we still have a lot more work to do. We're on the clock, and these goals are very, very hard. We should remember that as much as the Inflation Reduction Act achieves, and it's tremendous, it gets us around 40% by 2030 emissions below 2005 levels. Without this bill, we would have been on track for about 30%. So you're getting around a 10% additional reduction in emissions. That's a big deal, but we need to get to net zero, and we need to move really fast to do it.
Jason Bordoff is co-founding dean of the Columbia Climate School. He was also the director for energy and climate change on the National Security Council during the Obama administration. Thank you so much, Jason.
Thanks for the invitation to be with you. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the show, movies are one of the most culturally potent U.S. exports, from Buenos Aires to Tokyo to Cairo. Ross Melnick examines the soft power of American film in his new book, Hollywood Embassies. Our conversation with him is tomorrow on the show. That's it for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'll see you back here tomorrow.